In the summer of 1954, the Yangtze River flooded. At least 30,000 people were killed in one of the deadliest disasters of its kind in history. The timing, just 5 years after the founding of the People's Republic of China, embedded in the tragedy an additional layer of meaning. For the superstitious, it was not a cheerful start to the revolutionary cause. But rather than let this become a stain on the new nation, Mao seized the opportunity to assert the party's resilience and depict nature as a common enemy to be dominated, overcome, and ultimately conquered. 2 years after the floods, Mao swam the Yangtze in a triumph of propaganda. To commemorate this moment, the chairman wrote a poem in which he dreamed of constructing a wall of stone across the water so great it would impress even a mountain goddess. China's war on water had begun. The practical success of the many dams and dikes built during the Mao era was mixed, but the political success was unquestionable. Rivers are said to be the lifeblood of a nation, and the myths surrounding them are ripe for nation building. The Yellow and Yangtze rivers, in particular, are of special historical significance. The former, whose taming was arguably the foundation of early government, is considered the birthplace of China and holds over 40% of the country's farmland. Mao's preferred design for the new national flag featured only a single star and horizontal line representing the Yellow River. The Yangtze River, meanwhile, is pictured on banknotes and is the center of rice production, textiles, and much of the nation's industry. Control of water has long meant practical control of food, trade, energy, transportation, and protection against invaders. Damming these ancient waterways was therefore just as much a testament to China's strength as it was a means of managing water. Engineering the environment led to the perception of China, and more specifically, the party, as a force greater than nature, one strong, capable, and prudent enough to build something so colossal. It was in this same light that, 10 years after his first swim in the Yangtze, Mao returned to affirm his grip on power. Now 72 years old and facing a flurry of rumors about his health, he once again used his association with the river to demonstrate vitality. Accompanied by 6 floating bodyguards, Mao swam a whole 9 miles, according to state propaganda. And in 2003, 47 years later, Mao's wall of stone was realized. Indeed, in the Three Gorges Dam, the mighty Yangtze was finally conquered. Water spawned Chinese civilization. Control of water gave and later snatched away power from imperial dynasties. And the state's engineering dominance over water showed the world what it was capable of. It is thus rather poetic that someday very soon, water will once again play a defining role in China's future. Rather than suffering from too much water, as in the floods of decades past, today's China faces a different kind of challenge. Not enough of it. And it will severely inhibit the country's ambitions. In the past 20 years, 28,000 of its rivers have disappeared, equivalent to the entire basin area of the Mississippi. The flow of the Yellow River is now just 10% of what it was in the 1940s, making it the most threatened river in all of Asia. The number of dry-ups has increased rapidly. And that's just the beginning. But don't just take my word, take China's. Its leaders have called the water shortage a, quote, threat to the survival of the Chinese nation, announced the need to, quote, fight for every drop of water or die. And its own Ministry of Water Resources predicts a serious water crisis by 2030. Sponsored by Brilliant. Learn math, science, and computer science intuitively with a link in the description. The problem facing China is not exactly that it lacks water. Make no mistake, China has a lot. Its freshwater resources are the 5th highest in the world, behind only Brazil, Russia, the US, and Canada, two of which have the unfair advantage of lying in polar regions. And measured by the length of all navigable waterways, China is naturally blessed with the number one position, more than twice all of Europe combined, in fact. The problem slightly peeks its head out when we adjust for population. Per capita, China's freshwater ranking falls from 5th to 105th, something like 2,000 cubic meters to the world average of 8,000. Still, there are many large and even rich countries lower down on the list. China's per capita resources are only modestly lower than the UK's, and significantly higher than Germany's. One of the reasons China's water scarcity receives equally scarce attention is that it's well hidden in international comparisons. Only when we ask where its water is located do we really begin to understand the issue. When it comes to water, China is split in two, and the Yangtze is an inexact but useful artificial dividing line. To the south, the theme is wet. These subtropical latitudes receive lots and lots of rain. Average annual rainfall in the region is over 2,000 millimeters, most of which occurs in the summer. It should be no surprise then that the staple food here is rice, one of the most water-intensive crops. To the north of the Yangtze, think cold and dry. This is a temperate to arid region with only about 200 to 400 millimeters of annual rainfall. There's some rain, but not much, just barely enough to sustain agriculture, and noodles are the staple. The problem is not just where, but also when the water is located. Even what little precipitation the north does receive, it usually comes all at once, making it even less useful than these raw numbers imply. The same farm might contend with both seasonal droughts in the crucial spring months, followed by monsoon floods in July and August. And when one area experiences one, other areas are likely to simultaneously experience the other. Lack of water increases the concentration of salt in the soil, and the hot summer months then pull those salts to the surface. Irregular and unpredictable weather makes planning for these extremes difficult to impossible. And to make matters worse, climate change is aggravating regional differences, making the south even wetter and the north even drier. This north-south divide is the fundamental challenge facing China. Lots of water below the Yangtze, not enough above it. Water, of course, is renewed in a cycle. But natural laws do not obey the economic laws of supply and demand. The two halves of China share almost equal portions of GDP, industrial output, and population. Except the north holds only 20% of its water, and the south, 80%. You might assume that given this disparity, agriculture would be mainly concentrated in the south, but not so. 64% of total arable land and some 40% of farmland is located in the inhospitable and highly temperamental north. Put differently, the amount of freshwater per unit of farmland in the North China Plain is 15% of the country's average. We think of China as the world's producer, but the reality is that its ability to feed even itself is increasingly tenuous at best. And food is only the tip of the melting iceberg. Agriculture may account for the majority of the national water usage, but the resource it should be most fearful of is energy. It takes 24 bathtubs of water to produce 1 ton of coal, and yet 86% of its coal is produced in the north. It's true that China is actively reducing its reliance on coal, but when it comes to water, it doesn't all that much matter. 97% of its electricity requires water in one form or another, and neither oil, gas, nuclear, or hydropower is an effective solution. So while, yes, its reliance is decreasing over time, it's just not nearly fast enough. And because household use is so minuscule in comparison, water scarcity forces a trade-off between energy and food security, neither of which is palatable. Nowhere is the situation more dire than around the capital, Beijing, which makes the northern region as a whole look half serviceable. Recall that China has about 2,000 cubic meters of fresh water per person overall. Water stress is generally defined as just slightly less, 1,700 cubic meters per person. Scarcity starts at around 1,000 cubic meters, and acute scarcity around 500. Here are the per capita water resources in the country's 10 driest provinces. As of 2016, four were already below half the level of acute scarcity. The worst areas are in the same extreme category as Oman, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia. These are Chinese government-supplied figures. The Hai River Basin, which includes Beijing, is especially concerning thanks to the stark contrast between its huge population and scarce water resources. In 2016, the mayor announced that the city's population could not be allowed to grow past 23 million for this very reason. It's simply not sustainable. So far, we haven't painted a very pretty picture, but we've operated under a foolish assumption. We've taken for granted that all water is good water, which in China's case, it most definitely is not. The Chinese water quality system has five levels. Level 1 is nearly drinkable, 2 is lightly polluted but treatable, 3 can be swam or fished in, 4 can be used only for industry and never in contact with humans, and finally, level 5 is good for only one thing, irrigation. Anything worse is essentially useless. Already in 2013, over half of groundwater around Beijing was level 5 or worse. Just a quarter of the total could even be treated for human consumption. These days, the vast majority of groundwater is level 4 or 5, and nearly one-fifth is worse, meaning useless. Polluted drinking water presents both an economic and a human cost: disease, cancer, premature death, and immeasurable hardship. Environmental degradation has caused the possible extinction of the Yangtze River dolphin, and desertification has led to Beijing sandstorms so severe that they turn the sky a kind of dystopian yellow. That is, if you can see past the normal pollution. Given the absence of surface water in the north, cities have overextracted from underground aquifers, which carries several consequences. First, draining groundwater so completely leaves no backup in times of acute stress, like during unusually bad droughts. Second, removing aquifers causes the ground to collapse, leading to subsidence, which is when buildings, bridges, and other structures slowly and unevenly sink into the ground. Shanghai, for instance, has sunk by 2 meters in the last 2 decades. And, more embarrassingly, sections of the Great Wall are visibly eroding. When the question of where to find water arises, the inevitable answer is always desalination. Israel, also starved for water, has effectively solved its problem with 6 desalination plants, which provide the country with about 80% of its water. The difference between it and China, however, is that the former is tiny and rich. It's estimated that to desalinate and transfer 1 cubic meter of salt water from the coast of China inland would consume another 0.5 to 75 cubic meters of water in the process. Desalination is extremely energy intensive. China's energy comes mostly from coal, and coal uses lots and lots of water. Can you spot the problem? Well then, you might think, the problem is really only one of allocation. Water can be moved, so why not even out the geographic differences? Mao agreed. In 1954, he observed, very matter-of-factly, quote, "There's a lot of water in the south, but not much in the north. If we could borrow some, then everything would be okay." It took half a century, but Mao's suggestions do not go unanswered. The equally straightforwardly named South-North Water Transfer Project began operation in 2002. The largest in the world, it consists of 2,700 miles of artificial waterways and canals designed to do one thing: move water north. The Eastern Route is a major upgrade to the ancient Grand Canal, which pumps water from the Yangtze up to Tianjin. The central route, meanwhile, is also carried under the Yellow River, but by gravity, and all the way up to Beijing. A third western route is planned to connect the tributaries of the Yangtze to the Yellow River, and will be the most technically demanding, as its path intersects mountains. There's no doubt that the project, which spans 4 major rivers, 3 megacities, and 6 provinces, is a true engineering wonder. One could reasonably argue that only China has the unique combination of political and economic infrastructure to relocate entire towns, coordinate between such disparate levels of government, and make the requisite legal changes at this scale. This is not meant to imply that the project was uncontroversial. Expected to cost a massive $62 billion, it already exceeded that number a decade ago, and 345,000 people have been relocated in the process. Some are happy with their compensation, but others complain their new life is measurably worse. The first drop of water, meanwhile, reached Beijing in 2015, 7 years after the 2008 Summer Olympics, the original goal. Now, all of these costs would be one thing if the project singularly solved China's water woes. Unfortunately, not even close. Even if it supplied only the Beijing-Tianjin-Hebei area, these places would still be categorized as acutely scarce. Yet it's also responsible for 3 other provinces. Even at its imagined full capacity, it would only offset 1/4 of northern China's annual demand of 203 billion cubic meters by 2050, according to the Chinese Institute of Water Resources. In other words, decades of engineering, forced relocations, and environmental destruction all amount to, essentially, a band-aid. Perhaps worse than a band-aid, which may not heal wounds, but at least doesn't make them worse. These canals don't create water out of thin air, they merely move it, shifting the problem, quite literally, downstream. Southern provinces, worried about their own supply and quality of water, increasingly rely themselves on water transfer projects and dams from elsewhere. When the music stops, someone will pay the price. All of this makes the enormity of the project sort of ironic. On one hand, it represents an amazing technical accomplishment. On the other, it represents the extraordinary lengths China will go only to paint the superficial veneer of progress. The much more obvious solution is to target not supply, but demand. The price of water in China is among the lowest in the world, less than a third of what it is in the US, and just a quarter of the world average. Because water is so heavily subsidized, farmers have little reason to make efficient use of it. The most common method of irrigation is flooding, when farmers aimlessly dump water over their fields until most evaporates or runs off. About half of the water used in this process is wasted. These inefficiencies are reflected in China's low water productivity, which is defined as the crop value generated for every cubic meter of water used. Various regional governments have dabbled in market-based reforms, but not nearly as much as one would expect, given how much is at stake. Price adjustments are not, to be clear, some magical silver bullet, but they do raise an important question. Why did China spend $100 billion building a water conveyor belt from New York to LA when it could have just raised prices? Some experts point to the curiously high number of engineers among China's top ranks, many even specialized in hydraulics. At one point, all of the 9 Politburo Standing Committee members were engineers. It's probably true that hydraulic engineers see everything as a hydraulic engineering problem, and it doesn't hurt that the country has historically sought high-profile infrastructure projects as a means of gaining legitimacy. But there's another reason, one that has nothing at all to do with water in particular. The reason China opts for a band-aid to solve its water crisis is the same reason it waited decades to halt the one-child policy, long past when its disastrous effects were made clear, and the same reason it pays only lip service to the housing crisis. There's one thing China fears far, far more than a demographic, housing, or even water crisis. And it also just so happens to be the key to understanding its aggressive posture, why it seems to pick fights on the world stage and needlessly harm relations with other countries. Next time, in part 4 of China's Reckoning. While I was writing these videos, I remembered learning in school about population pyramids, water conservancy, and economics. None of it seemed very interesting to me then, and the only difference was how the information was presented. One of my goals for this channel is to inform and educate, but in a way that you actually enjoy. It's with that same philosophy that Brilliant is designed to teach you science, math, and computer science in a way that's immersive and engaging. You learn with Brilliant not by memorizing formulas, but by doing, and always in service of a clear goal. Lessons are designed more like interactive games than lectures. Take this one, for instance, in which you learn science by doing puzzles. Whatever you want to learn, Python, statistics, quantum computing, or physics, Brilliant's got a course for you, and you can jump between them whenever and however often you like. Learn something new today by going to brilliant.org/polymatter and signing up for free. The first 200 of you will also get 20% off the annual premium subscription.